Ready?
Good morning. Welcome to Providence Grand Rounds for February or January. Jumping ahead. This morning, we have Dr. Yorgos Lozides, local rheumatologist, to speak on some rheumatology cases. Dr. Lozides was educated at the University of Athens and did residency and fellowship in Philadelphia, and then worked at Thomas Jefferson University for 5 years before joining us here in the Rogue Valley. Thank you, and happy to have you this morning.
Very happy to be here. Thank you so much. Good morning, everyone. I hope everyone can hear me well. I'm Yorgos Lozides. I'm going to be presenting a few cases and have a little bit of discussion about common rheumatologic conditions that you guys see as first line care that patients receive. I don't have any financial disclosures. I cannot change the slide here. Let's see. Do I have to click on this? Sorry. You see my slides? Okay. I don't have any relevant financial disclosures. My goals is basically to talk a little bit about best practice in diagnosis and initial management of common autoimmune diseases. I'm going to talk a little bit about rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, polymyalgia rheumatica, and giant cell arteritis. And then last but not least, I'm going to talk about ANAs. I see the role of primary care in autoimmune diseases are multifaceted as the rheumatologist's role. Primary care really identifies and suspects when a patient presents with symptoms that are suspicious for an autoimmune disease, but their role doesn't just stop in a diagnosis, but also has to do with management of comorbidities that are a result of autoimmune diseases and vice versa. Managing comorbidities improve autoimmune diseases management. So I'm going to start with a case, a 53-year-old woman with past medical history of anxiety, smoking, and insomnia. She presents to the primary care office with hand pain over the past 4 months. She has noted increased difficulty in donning her wedding ring due to perceived changes in finger size. But the day that she presents to the primary care office, she doesn't have much tenderness on palpation of the affected hand. But she reports that consistently she has had pain over the past 3 weeks prior to consultation. She received some x-rays that only showed mild degenerative joint disease, meaning osteoarthritis of the first carpometacarpal joints, and then labs showed normal inflammatory markers and serological tests, including rheumatoid factor and ANA, were negative. And then the way I imagine it is that there is a question: do you refer this patient to a specialist or you do not refer this patient to a specialist? For example, the patient says, I've had swelling, I've had morning stiffness. Those are clues for an inflammatory disease. But then I also recognize that the patient has had negative rheumatoid factor, has had negative ANA, normal inflammatory markers, and then at the day of the office, she has no swelling. And therefore, you don't have enough clues to justify that this patient has inflammatory arthritis. how can you really move forward and decide if this patient is at risk? Well, there is more history and there is more workup. More history, a good way to start will be a good family history. And I would give patients examples. Anyone in your family with history of RA, psoriasis, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, psoriasis. Patients usually don't think what an autoimmune disease is, but they respond well to names of diseases. I would also ask about the duration of swelling. Was it a few hours? Was it a few days? Was it a week? And I think it's improved, improved or not, or yes or no, this is important information. And then I would also ask the patient if they took ibuprofen before they came to the office or any other NSAIDs, because that can reduce the swelling, especially in the beginning of the disease. And an intentional weight loss is also an important clue. I see often that many providers, when they evaluate a patient with hand pain, they order a rheumatoid factor and an ANA. But I think important consideration, middle-aged woman and any other one that presents with hand pain, CCP antibody is something that should be ordered if you suspect inflammatory arthritis, and not just an ANA. I would also consider an SSA antibody, because Sjogren's disease is very, very common and very, very underdiagnosed. And when you evaluate a patient with an autoimmune disease, CED rate and CRP, yes, they are great, but CBC, CMP are also important. If a patient has a picture of their hand swelling also, that's very nice to have and gives you an idea if you should refer this patient or not. 10 to 20% of patients with rheumatoid arthritis will be seronegative, meaning that they will have negative rheumatoid factor, they will have negative CCP antibody. And the CED rate and CRP can be non-specific for inflammatory arthritis. There is no troponin for inflammatory arthritis. Best way to diagnose inflammatory arthritis is looking at a holistic picture of the patient, includes history, family history, physical exam, and sometimes you have to see the patient more than once to establish a trajectory of symptoms. So usually what we're taught in med school is that rheumatoid arthritis presents as symmetric arthritis and it starts all of a sudden, but the reality is that before rheumatoid arthritis even become symmetric arthritis, there might be a period of disease activity that they might have one or two inflamed joints, and the patient won't come and say, I have one or two inflamed joints. That's something that we tease out with clinical evaluation. So having one wrist that has been swollen for a few months can still be a presentation of rheumatoid arthritis. Rheumatoid arthritis, before it becomes a disease, an established disease, they might have prodrome syndromes, that it might sound like migratory arthritis. It might sound that a few joints were swollen for a few days and then it went away. This is something that should trick evaluation, even with a referral, even blood work. And that's something that I think it's important, because the sooner we diagnose these patients, the better. But not every patient with rheumatoid arthritis presents with symmetric small joint polyarthritis, just we are looking at the books. 43-year-old woman, this another patient, presents to the office with subacute hand pain, wrist pain for the past 2 months. She notes swelling over the metacarpal joints and she has elevated CED rate, positive rheumatoid factor, positive CCP, slam dunk diagnosis, rheumatoid arthritis. So these are the pictures that we classically see. We can see here the MCP swelling. We don't see the valleys, or what we call the valleys of the MCP joints, but we also see swelling of the PIP joints, which is, can be very characteristic of rheumatoid arthritis, but what you don't see is swelling of the distal interphalangeal joints. You see swelling of the distal interphalangeal joints, of course, osteoarthritis is an important consideration, or if we want to go to inflammatory arthritis, psoriatic arthritis is an important one. And why do we make even a conversation why this patient needs to be diagnosed early and even in their preclinical disease? It was important to be diagnosed because an undiagnosed disease over time, and most, not every patient, but a lot of patients will have irreversible joint damage over the years. So a very, very good test in terms of rheumatoid arthritis to check when you evaluate a patient, even if they don't have swelling, is the metacarpal squeeze test. This is like a bread and butter. It is not big. It's not big science here, but there is some good data that if you squeeze someone metacarpal like this, even for what, just 1 second, and they have pain in the metacarpal joints, and if they give you the right history, is the fastest way of them to be diagnosed with a potential inflammatory arthritis. So I bring some ultrasound pictures here because I think it's the best way to understand what are the initial changes. So you think about pneumonia, then the first change that you might see on X-ray is some opacities in one of the lobes. Well, in the joint, the thing that we're interested in are two, is swelling of the joint, and two is if there is hyperemia of the synovium. So if we had to look at a joint where the two metacarpal and post-metacarpal bones are coming to form a joint, there is a small synovial cleft that should be normal in a patient. But the initial form of arthritis, what we see is that this cleft becomes a little bit of swollen. That you might not see on physical exam, but that's what the patient will tell you. They would say, I feel puffy and I feel swollen. So two things happen over time as they develop inflammatory arthritis. One is that this cleft, the synovium, starts from going normal to be swollen. And then after it becomes swollen, and I can show you the progression here, then there is an invasion of the immune system in the synovial tissues, and how that presents is with hyperemia. And you can see that actually on ultrasound, bringing this up because ultrasound is a great diagnostic tool if a patient is not on any steroids or NSAIDs to order if a patient is suspected for inflammatory arthritis. And why I'm bringing this, because the field and the need that we have in rheumatoid arthritis and in inflammatory arthritis to diagnose patients as early as possible, even in the preclinical disease. And here is an example, a 53-year-old man with history of diabetes and obesity presents with paroxysmal reported hand swelling. He notes that he has pain in his metacarpophalangeal joints that might last for 24 to 48 hours and then resolves with NSAIDs. He has mildly elevated set rate, normal CRP, and he has negative ANA, negative rheumatoid factor, negative CCP. But when he comes to the office, he does have pain over the MCPs and the PIPs without swelling and without profound osteoarthritis. So I'm going to show the two spectrums here, meaning you can have on the left side a hand that doesn't look apparently swollen, like we were taught that inflammatory arthritis presents like, meaning with swelling. But in the microscopic level and the synovium level, patients can very, very much have synovial thickening it's not as a pattern of physical exam. And especially in people with muscular hands, people who are doing jobs that they have forearms that are very hypertrophied in terms of muscle, you might not pick up the real swelling, but the ultrasound will. And there's this whole discussion about, okay, do patients wake up one day and they develop a disease, like rheumatoid arthritis, just like someone with pneumonia? Well, we do think that there is a prodrome, there is a preclinical disease. And we know that if sometimes people have genetic risk, family history, but dental care also goes and promotes inflammation, cigarette smoking. A good question is if wildfires also make people more at risk for developing autoimmune diseases. And then they go back and forth with inflammation, and some of them present with clinical disease, but some people might not actually develop a disease, and that's a whole different discussion. But in the preclinical stage, instead of having inflammation within the joint, a lot of people have inflammation out of the joint. That's why their symptoms can be non-specific. And while this is sounds fancy in terms of pathophysiological approach, the reality is that good history, a good physical exam will always give you the clues to even start suspecting. And then as you see the patient one after one time, ask for more information, ask for pictures, then you get into a diagnosis. So this is another case. 45-year-old woman with past medical history of diabetes, fatty liver disease, and obesity presents with complaints of bilateral elbow pain. She has tenderness of the region of the triceps tendon bilaterally, but there is absence of tenderness palpation over the common extensor and flexor tendon joints. She has elevated set rate, CRP is normal, that you're suspecting that the patient might have an inflammatory disease. She has negative rheumatoid factor, negative ANA, and the x-rays of the elbows are normal. Again, the question, to refer or not to refer? Here is a little bit easier. Well, patient has elevated set rate, must have something inflammatory. But then on exam, you examine the patient, she has pain, but she doesn't have swelling. She has negative rheumatoid factor. She has negative ANA. Again, we ask about more information about the patient. What other joints has she had? Has she had any evidence of inflammatory eye disease? For example, uveitis or scleritis. Inflammatory eye disease is something that the patient will remember because it's painful. Family history of inflammatory bowel disease, a personal history of psoriasis, family history of psoriasis, very important question. If a patient has family history of psoriasis in a first degree relative, that should increase your level of suspicion for an inflammatory disease. And when you examine the patient, include the joints, of course, that's what we do in rheumatology. We check the enthesis, meaning the tendons, where the tendons goes and enters the bone structure, nail disease, Achilles tendon pain. A lot of times patients might have psoriasis diagnosed years before they present with any joint pain. The psoriatic arthritis in the community is a little bit more tricky, a little bit more sneaky, because it can be much more fluctuating, slowly evolving disease. Patients will develop with might present, yes, acutely, with polyarthritis, but there is a good amount of patients, which we see every day, that they report intermittent musculoskeletal symptoms over years, such as plantar fasciitis for many years that doesn't go away, swollen knee that appears to develop after a twist, or a swollen finger that, or a toe that lasts for a few days. These patients, we see them all the time, and really the first line of diagnosis or suspicion comes from primary care, and those patients that have access to primary care are very thankful when they eventually diagnosed. So 30% of patients with psoriatic arthritis will present with arthritis before 30% of patients will have psoriasis and arthritis present at the same time. Approximately 15%, they will first present with the inflammatory joint disease and then the cutaneous disease. And sometimes also finding the cutaneous disease, not everyone is going to present with plaques over the elbows and over the knees. You really have to look for psoriasis, particularly in the hairline and behind the ears, armpits, umbilicus, in order to find evidence of psoriasis. Or you might ask the patient about this. And a lot of times when we see the patients, they're already on steroids, which will resolve these small clues. But if you ask the patient, if you show them pictures on Google, that's where Google might be useful for us at this point, is to find pictures that gives you clues to diagnose. And the patient will say, well, yeah, I have these types of plus, but I bought over-the-counter steroid cream and they were they resolved. So psoriatic arthritis, Cetrid and CRP are not always elevated. They cannot be used as troponins for inflammatory arthritis. Yes, they can be many times elevated in inflammatory diseases, but a lot of times patients present with normal inflammatory markers. Anemia, thrombocytosis, those are clues for inflammation that go beyond Cetrid and CRP. Morning stiffness, swelling, nail changes, Achilles tendon pain, family history of psoriasis or Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis are also very important clues for someone to ask the patient and decide if they might have psoriatic arthritis. So whereas besides diagnosis, the other thing that is very, very important in management of this patient is the comorbidities. So sleep apnea, insomnia, sleep hygiene, obesity, exercise, walking, aqua therapy, very, very important things to consider when you see these patients. Stopping smoking, important, metabolic syndrome. There is a bidirectional relationship between obesity and psoriatic arthritis in terms of how active they can be. And as you very well know, obesity or poor sleep affects how much pain patients feel. If they don't sleep very well, they're going to be in more pain. And that's sometimes very difficult to explain to someone who has chronic pain. Okay, GCA. 40-year-old woman presents with past medical history of migraines, endometriosis, and insomnia, presents to the emergency room with acute onset of right-sided retroorbital headache over the past 4 days. She's not a blurry vision on the other side, on the right side. She exhibits tenderness around the temporal area. Cetrid, she has a Cetrid of 42 and CRP is normal of 1.3. Does this patient have enough evidence that to claim that she has GCA? Well, again, to refer or not to refer. Elevated Cetrid is a clue, but being less than 50 years old, it's almost unheard of for someone to have GCA. So I'm just gonna talk a little bit about PEARLS, about GCA. The sensitivity of a temporal artery biopsy is 60 to 70%. So that's where history has a very, very important role in determining if someone has GCA, meaning you can still have GCA with negative temporal artery biopsy, but the temporal artery biopsy needs to happen within a week after patients present. A lot of times what we see in practice that patients present with headache and elevated Cetrid, they're started on steroids, and then they're scheduled to have a temporal artery biopsy 3 weeks or a month after their presentation. That biopsy is probably going to be negative after they've been on steroids, and therefore it will probably have us no use unless we find something else on biopsy that might be explaining the symptoms. These patients, if there is an ambiguity in terms of diagnosis, and I'm talking about this situation about age, is less than 50 years old, maybe they need more workup. Maybe they should have an MRA of their neck and their brain to look for any evidence of inflammation, because even a negative MRA at the beginning of their disease is an important information. And then clinical history is important. If someone is more than 50 years old and you are evaluating them, yes, not everyone is going to present with a new headache that has tenderness over the temporal area. Patients might have weird symptoms, a dry cough that is new and unexplained. They might have ear pain, but if a patient has jaw claudication, that's probably one of the best symptoms that gives you a positive predictive value in terms of having a biopsy. What is jaw claudication? It's not necessarily pain when they start to chew. A lot of patients have TMJ, and that will give them pain that will get worse with if they have headache. Is discomfort not in the first time they start to chew, it's after 10 or 15 bites that the difficulty starts to begin. The patient will not say that to you unless you ask them. So it's important. So GCA workup, what we don't want to see in general is that, oh, headache, elevated CRP, get some steroids, follow up with rheumatology. This is a type of approach that is a little bit outdated. Now, what we think about is we need good clinical history. We need the earliest referral as possible. Sometimes these patients need to be hospitalized in order to get a timely artery biopsy. Maybe they need an MRA. Maybe they need evaluation of larger vessels. And that's something that they need, this type of image, quite immediately, because we don't want them to be on steroids for too long before you do these exams. It sometimes requires a multidisciplinary approach, meaning an ophthalmologic exam. We need very good history about any vision changes, and that needs to be correlated with an ophthalmologic exam. What did the ophthalmologist see in the retina? What is the type of headache? Not everyone with elevated saturated and CRP with new onset headache has GCA. So in neurology evaluation, which I know in this area we are lacking a lot of neurologists, and it's paramount because there are other types of headache that people might have that might have acute onset that need to be evaluated. For example, orbital migraines, complex migraines, cluster headache, or other types of headache that are beyond GCA. If someone has a temporal artery biopsy that is negative, MRI, MRA negative, and history that is inconsistent, maybe they don't have a GCA. And why is this important to think about? Because not uncommonly, patients present on steroids. We see patients that have been on steroids for a month or two, and they say, oh, I went to the emergency room, maybe I have GCA. In the meantime, I put on 30 pounds and I still have headaches and I'm on 30 milligrams of prednisone. Well, probably this person doesn't have GCA, or maybe they need more evaluation. That's why I think that exploring differentials in terms of headache beyond GCA, it's important to be done earlier on the disease, because steroids will make everyone, almost everyone, feel better. The concept of patients felt better on steroids and therefore they have something inflammatory, it's not, unfortunately, it's not in any of diagnostic or classification criteria, and it's a useful tool, but it should not stop us from thinking broadly about someone's presentation. So GCA rarely occurs in patients that are less 50 years of age. In a study of 1,400 patients and a meta-analysis of 26 studies, there were only two patients that were less than 50 years old. So if someone less than 50 years old, very, very rarely would have GCA. GCA is not reported among African Americans, and particularly African American men. In a pretty big study from Johns Hopkins in Baltimore that is 65% African American, there were 90 cases of biopsy-proven temporal arteritis, and they compared that to controls. And I believe only 5% were African Americans, and all of them were women, something that we don't see in other races. So, again, true GCA is always characterized by temporal arteries that are abnormal on physical examination. That's a myth. A very small percentage of patients will present with an abnormal temporal artery exam. If you see that, that's great, then it increases the chance of having positive biopsy, but the reality is that not everyone is going to present like that. You have to have untreated disease for very long in order to have what we call the nodular temporal artery. The headaches of GCA, unfortunately, based on the data, they can be very non-specific. It doesn't have to be over the temporals. It doesn't have to be their worst headache of their life. I think that if anyone is not a headache person and all of a sudden they develop a new headache and or new cranial symptom that is above the neck and it cannot be explained with any other investigation, GCA should be in the differential. There have been reports of patients been diagnosed as sinusitis or otitis media, and recognizing and teasing out this from the patient is, I understand, and I know it's not very easy. GCA can present as fever of unknown origin in 10 to 16% of patients with FUO. And then it's important to remember that if a patient has fever from GCA, they might have a normal white blood cell count. And GCA might not present as, again, with a classic headache. It might present with fever. And the only way you're going to diagnose this is with imaging of the big vessels. That's why I brought up hospitalization multidisciplinary approach. So vision loss, it's a number one concern. When we think about GCA, that's why we treat empirically until investigation is complete. Most of the patients will have anterior ischemic optic neuropathy. Retinal artery occlusion is about 20% of the patient. But what I wanted to bring up is that diplopia is a symptom that it was that is more common than it was previously acknowledged. So if a patient presents with a new onset headache and diplopia, it's something that we should start thinking about GCA and trigger the workup that includes rheumatology referral and a biopsy. I'm bringing this slide again because clinical history, early referral, even hospitalization, official ophthalmologic exam, ideally, neurology evaluation as well, and a biopsy before the week mark of starting someone's steroids. If you suspect it, then go ahead. I'm not saying don't start steroids. If you suspect it, probably you have to start treating, but it's important that the patient gets full diagnostic evaluation so they're not stuck with steroids for months and months and months and be exposed to the comorbidities of chronic steroid use. Now, 59-year-old woman present with past medical history of migraines, presents with bilateral shoulder pain, stiffness for the past 3 days. She does not have any headaches. She has difficulty flexing and abducting the shoulder. She has elevated ESR and CRP. She started 20 milligrams of prednisone. She feels great. She follow-ups with rheumatology. Something that I wanted to bring up today that I think it's important when we diagnose PMR, which is a very common disease and one of the most rewarding in terms of treating, I would always check rheumatoid factor and CCP in these cases, patients. And sometimes I do even later in the disease. Why? Because sometimes rheumatoid arthritis and PMR might present the exact same way, meaning with shoulder inflammatory arthritis, and might be difficult sometimes to differentiate the two of them. PMR, though, the key characteristic is that they have very sudden onset in their symptomatology. The patient is going to say, I slept well on the 17th of January, on the 18th, I started having pain. That's a very characteristic of PMR, as opposed to RA, as we said before, when they might have relapsing remitting type of disease for a few months before they present. When you see a patient, always screen for headache, jaw claudication, vision changes when you see a patient with PMR, because PMR and GCA can exist in continuum. So if a patient says, hey, I have a headache and symptoms of PMR, consider GCA to be part of their disease. Also, other parts that you can think about PMR and expanding the differential is exerve the cervical spine, calcification, CPPD, radiculopathy can present with bilateral shoulder pain and will respond to steroids, meaning that steroids will make people feel better, and feeling better on steroids is not a diagnostic tool for an inflammatory condition. It's useful, but radiculopathy can also respond to steroids really well. Also, fibromyalgia pain responds to steroids. So morning stiffness in the shoulder is an important clue. The shoulder movement normalizes within hours after you start steroids. And in the past, we used to talk the classic PMR response that can really differentiate for other diagnoses, but we have to keep always our mind open because steroids are bad and we want to make sure that we give steroids to people when they absolutely need them. When you examine patients with PMR, is there active range of motion that will be painful? If you are able to move their shoulders, that shouldn't be painful. That is because PMR is actually a periarthritis and not a true arthritis. That's why they have normal passive range of motions. And I think that's another useful tool when you see them. Something that is a little bit more advanced, but if patients present with PMR-like symptoms and they also have calf pain, we should also be checking an ANCA, because sometimes ANCA-associated vasculitis, which is a very rare disease, can present that way. But there is some data to suggest that if they present with calf pain, do not forget ANCA testing. If someone needs more than 25 milligrams of prednisone, then probably they don't have PMR. 15 milligrams of prednisone is usually enough to control the symptoms for most patients, and 20 milligrams is almost in everyone. Failure to control symptoms with more than 25 milligrams of prednisone should prompt evaluation of a different diagnosis. I'm going to bring up radiculopathy. I'm going to bring up osteoarthritis of the shoulder, which is very painful. And of course, the all good fibromyalgia. Distinguishing PMR for rheumatoid arthritis, I think it's important, especially if patients don't have access to rheumatology quite fast, because they might present as patients that have difficulty tapering off steroids. You might start on 15 milligrams and then you go down to 10 and then their pain comes back or their wrist starts to swell. That's an important clue that you might thing about rheumatoid arthritis. Okay, my favorite. So 43-year-old woman with past medical history of depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, sleep apnea presents with a chief complaint of generalized pain and described as pain all over. I've also heard the description, I have pain since birth. She reports that the pain is severe enough to disrupt her sleep at night. Despite regular use over the counter pain relievers like ibuprofen and Tylenol, she experienced relief in symptoms. Lab evaluation is revealing a normal inflammatory markers, including a set rate that is normal, C-reactive protein that is also normal. Additionally, serological tests showed a negative result for rheumatoid factor and a positive result for ANA. So I don't want to go into too much detail about ANA testing, but there are, in the Rock Valley, I've seen two types of testing that is used from the different hospitals as well as commercial labs. One is the immunofluorescence method, and the other one is the ELISA testing. I think the hospitals now are moving towards ELISA testing. I'm going to show you examples of that. ELISA test is basically tells you this is positive or this is negative, and then that's just it. The immunofluorescence method, though, it will tell you, okay, the ANA is 1 to 40, 1 to 80, 1 to 160, 1 to 320. Those are the two types of ANA testing, and I think it's very important that we just acknowledge them. It's a different way that the lab is testing it. It has to do with how difficult it is. The immunofluoresces is skill dependent, an expensive way of testing ANA. Versus the ELISA is just faster and easier and cheaper. That's great, but it comes with some negative, some missing information as far as to what type of ANA it has. So I literally took a picture of different ANAs to show you. So this is the ELISA. It's going to come as a, and by the way, this is a patient that had two times the ANA testing 7 years ago, 6 years ago, two times were negative. So what you see is the units and the screen. It gives you a unit and a screen. That's because this is an automated process. No one goes and sees, okay, how positive this ANA is. Is it 140, 1280, 1 to 1280? It will not give you this type of information. This is a negative ANA test. Now, this is a very, very, very common positive ANA test. What does it tell you? It tells you that ANA was a little bit detected. And how? Why do I say a little bit? Because 10 units per ml is considered negative. This is 12. And then the selected antigens is it's a bread and I'm not a lab person, but it's not as good as doing an immunofluorescence. The selected antigens gives you an idea if a patient, besides having an ANA, they might have an SSA and an RNP or a Smith antibody. That's what selected antigens means. So this is an ELISA method. Again, it's tested positive, but then patients might have more antigens there. It's a good way to screen, but to the specialist view, this type of ANA doesn't really mean much, meaning that if I see a patient, regardless almost of what they're complaining about, if I wanted to understand the ANA, then I would go into the immunofluorescence, meaning that we really need to know how positive is the ANA, and we also need to know what's the ANA pattern. There are different types of ANA, and not every ANA pattern is equal. No, not all of the ANAs are equal. And I bought the nuclear dense fine speckle because this type of ANA is actually associated with no connective tissue disease. It's not absolute, but we have more data that if you see this type of ANA pattern, even if it's high, even if they come to the office, we know beforehand that probably they don't have a connective tissue disease. Of course, they might have another autoimmune disease. That's a different story. So this is the patient journey into ANA. Once they see an ANA on my chart, they're going to go on Google. They're going to say, positive ANA, what does it mean? And then the Google, correctly so, it's going to say a positive result of ANA means anti-nuclear antibodies were found in your blood, which may be a sign of systemic lupus erythematosus. That's it. That word is going to stay in their mind forever. So what happens is that the reality of that positive ANA is that in majority of time, it's not lupus. And I'm not saying don't test an ANA. We will test an ANA. I test ANA every day that I probably know that it's not lupus. It's just what we do in medicine is how we screen for autoimmune diseases. But the key in what we want to think about is how we manage the ANA. And the ANA, we have to know how positive the ANA is and what pattern is the ANA. It's different if someone has homogeneous pattern, it's different if someone has fine speckle pattern, in terms how it's different if someone has dense fine speckle pattern. And of course, we have great respect for centromere pattern, cytoplasmic pattern, nucleural pattern. These type of patterns will not be in the screening test when we check an ELISA test on patients. And therefore, why am I bringing this now? I'm bringing this now because when we say that we're going to test an ANA to the patient or a patient comes back with a positive ANA, I would never say to the patient or document in the chart, your symptoms are possibly consistent with lupus. Because if you just have a positive screening for ELISA, unless you have tremendous sign of lupus, for example, malar rash, glomerulonephritis, diffuse arthritis, something that is unequivocally very suspicious for lupus, I would refrain from the phrase, your symptoms might be connected with lupus. Because even if the patient doesn't see a rheumatologist, even if the patient doesn't see you back yourself, moves to California, moves to Washington, moves to Idaho, they will say to their next provider, I have past medical history of lupus. And that will have very specific outcomes in how new providers are seeing those patients, with the most feared outcome of the given steroids without them needing them. So that's why I think the ANA discussion before or after you order it has to be very specific. I think the best statement is you had a positive ANA, your symptoms require more evaluation. I think that's the best statement you can say to the patient rather than ever say your symptoms might be consistent with lupus. And a lot of patients will say, I have a positive ANA and I have a malar rash. And always the reflex response to a rheumatologist's mind is you might not have a malar rash. Meaning, if you indeed suspect that a patient has a malar rash or any type of facial rash, you should send them to dermatology. Have them take a picture, send them to dermatology, if with, without the ANA testing, with and without a rheumatology visit. I think it's very important in the beginning, especially if this is a new sign, to be described well, because not all facial rash that looks like malar rash is actually malar rash. And this is the most common is rosacea. A lot of people might have rosacea. A lot of people have rosacea and they have a positive ANA. That doesn't mean they have lupus. But they depend in my eyes, I can see rosacea, but the differential can be much more broad in a patient. If the patient sees a dermatologist, they can have acute lupus, they can have tumitus lupus, they can have sarcoid, discoid, simple acne. I think it's important. And when a patient understands their symptoms, then they are able to self-manage. And then when they come back to the office for whatever other symptoms, they feel understood, they feel heard, and therefore they are able to describe the symptoms back to you much more accurately. As opposed to, I have lupus, everything that I have as a symptom is lupus. And this is like a little bit going deep into the immunologic criteria when we do see patients with positive antibodies. For example, they have positive ANA, positive double-stranded DNA, we really need to see these clinical objective tools to suspect an autoimmune disease. I'm just bringing here the SLIC criteria in order to show that. For example, acute cutaneous lupus, chronic cutaneous lupus, oral or nasal ulcers that are usually non-painful. That's why it's difficult to diagnose. If a patient has mouth ulcers that are painful, probably not lupus. They might have a general phthosis. So it really has to be diagnosed in the acute setting than being reported. Arthritis, you really need to have inflammatory arthritis or inflammatory arthralgias. Body pain is not part of the criteria of lupus. Renal disease, when you have a positive ANA, check a CBC, check a UA. If they have lymphopenia, if they have thrombocytopenia, if they have blood in their urine, protein in their urine that is unexplained, that's a significant way that we diagnose real lupus as opposed to reported lupus. Hemolytic anemia is another sign. Coombs test, very easy test to check. But if someone has a positive ANA, they have a say, they have positive Coombs, they fulfill criteria for the potential diagnosis. So it's important to go beyond the ANA in terms of how we diagnose lupus. And that's why when we order an ANA and when we interpret an ANA, I would say this requires more evaluation. I would not write in the chart or say these symptoms might be consistent with lupus, because although that's what you're thinking, and you might be right or you might not be right, or 3 years down the line, they might develop lupus, which is the case. It's important that the patient understands that having a lupus is not just a positive ANA, and vice versa. If their ANA is negative, probably they don't have lupus. What is the fate of a positive ANA when it's not lupus? If we're talking about inflammatory diseases, sometimes people might have Sjogren's syndrome, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, undifferentiated connective tissue disease. They might eventually be diagnosed with vasculitis, scleroderma, or dermatomyositis, which are rare diseases. But that's the fate of a positive ANA. If it's an inflammatory condition, if it's a non-inflammatory condition, a lot of times they have really fibromyalgia, really osteoarthritis, mechanical back pain, regular soft tissue rheumatism, osteoarthritis, very commonly in this area, hypermobility syndrome, extremely common. In my humble opinion, the past 3 months that I've practiced rheumatology in this area, sleep apnea and depression. Sleep apnea, undiagnosed sleep apnea, can present with joint pain. Depression can cause body pain. And why am I bringing these non-inflammatory diseases? Is because the way that the patient will receive care in the health system really depends on understanding, okay, I have a positive ANA, but I don't have lupus. Then why am I in pain? Why do I have pain? And educating the patient about the different types of pain, it's very, very important, because only in my humble experience, and I think in yours, only the patient understands the origin of their symptoms and understands the complexity of their body, it will be more likely to participate in the avenue that you will tell them, and that we will suggest to them. That it means physical therapy, that means aqua therapy, that means screening for sleep apnea, that means exercise. A lot of times patients with arthritis and pain are afraid to exercise, and that's more common than you think. They're afraid to exercise because they think that when they have a little bit more pain with exercise, it's going to make their arthritis worse. So maybe if there is one thing to say, is that we have to encourage exercise that respects joint pain, but doesn't allow patients to stay in bed all day immobile, because that will make any type of pain, inflammatory or non-inflammatory, worse. Last, when we order an ANA, we have to educate the patient that this is just a marker. A positive test does not mean they have an autoimmune disease. Thyroid disease, family history of an autoimmune disease, can be very well a reason for a positive ANA. And when it's positive, I would just explain to the patient that, hey, your symptoms require more evaluation rather than give them a diagnosis unless you're absolutely sure that they fulfill criteria for an autoimmune disease. Facial rash, make them take a picture, refer them to rheumatology. Would not say this is a malar rash unless you're absolutely sure. Lupus is a rare disease. When you check an ANA, always check a CBC and a CMP and a UA. If they have hand swelling, wrist swelling, foot swelling, feel free to order an ultrasound in addition to X-ray without them being on NSAID on steroids. That's a useful test when you decide if they have an inflammatory condition or not. Those are my references, and I hope I'm not out of time. Open to any questions. I don't know if they're going to be.
Let's see here. Thank you. That was a lot of information.
Yes.
A couple of questions. First, is a temporal artery ultrasound useful when you suspect?
Yes. So, yes, it is useful, but you really need to have a very experienced ultrasonographer and a radiologist, and that's usually in centers that utilize this tool for that. That might include the temporal arteries and the axillary arteries. A positive test is useful. And if we have it in our disposal, I think it's good to use in addition with a positive biopsy or imaging of the large vessels. In Europeans are much more likely to use this tool as part of the diagnosis. The word in the streets is that you really need to have a timely fashion and a good center that are very well versed in the ultrasound or sonographic abnormalities that you might see with the GCA.
Great.
Yeah.
A couple of questions related to PMR. First, would you recommend that we refer all those patients? Do you feel like primary care can manage PMR most of the time, or what criteria for referral?
I think absolutely primary care can manage PMR if they feel that is the diagnosis and we don't have other comorbid autoimmune conditions such as rheumatoid arthritis and psoriatic arthritis. I think rheumatologists should see the patient at least once to tease if there are any evidence of GCA. And I think that rheumatologists should also see the patient in case you have trouble tapering the steroids, because now sarilumab is one of the medications approved for PMR. And some patients, if they have difficulty tapering steroids, they might be good to have this medication on board.
Yeah, that was another question I had. We have patients who don't want to take steroids and what options are there?
Yes. I think sarilumab is one of the options, but it's not a few times that patients have have PMR diagnosis, 7 or 6 months of steroids. They come to the rheumatology office and then they have positive rheumatoid CCP, and therefore their choice will be methotrexate, and they do really well. Yeah.
Right. To see thank you any others.
I would appreciate a summary of literature on reversible triggers of autoimmune disease and potential testing to detect the trigger.
You get that?
No, I did not see that.
A summary of literature on reversible triggers of autoimmune diseases.
Which autoimmune disease? This is a very important and a nice question and a common question. I think the best studied way in terms of reversing the chance of developing an autoimmune disease is really smoking in rheumatoid arthritis specifically. Smoking causes people to have positive CCP antibodies, and that goes into preclinical disease in the area that we live. With the amount of wildfire smoke, I think that's something to be determined. What I advise patients with preclinical rheumatoid arthritis for sure to have in their houses good air filters, because I don't see any reason why smoking as opposed to wildfire won't cause lung inflammation that would then lead to positive CCP antibodies. So the best study in terms we're talking about literature, I think smoking will be number one. Now, there is some literature, not from this country, about plant-based diets. We know that food is inflammatory. I'm not aware of any studies that shows that it can reverse an autoimmune disease, but in rheumatoid arthritis, I know that plant-based diet has been associated with significantly lower disease activity in terms of In terms of established disease, now reversal of disease, that would be very, very difficult to study, but that would be a very nice study to do. But it's not a bad advice to tell the patients to eat an anti-inflammatory diet, not necessarily plant-based diet, anti-inflammatory diet, which is a mixture of Mediterranean diet as well as Asian diet that is rich in vegetables. The more processed food, the worse. Hope I answered the question.
Doesn't look like there's any more questions.
That was a great question. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you
for having me.
Thank you very much.
I wish a great day to everyone.
Thank you.